industry or dairy workers, say, looking at how they might be affected by a change in import rules. We don't have that this time. What we have are some very general statements about what they might do, and then text that gets leaked through WikiLeaks or maybe coming from the European Union. So it's a crazy process, and I think what you see is more and more groups across the country and in various countries finding ways to get that information. But it really doesn't have to be that way. There's no reason they couldn't open up the process, that they couldn't consult on these food and farm issues with people who would need to hear about it. And in any case, honor a notion they have in Europe, one of the founding ideas of the European Union, of subsidiarity, that decisions get made at the lowest level practical. So if a community is deciding they're going to ban a toxic pesticide, allow room for that. Base our decision-making on things like pesticides and food safety on the precautionary principle. When there's uncertainty, err on the side of caution. These are the kinds of things that should be the principles we're looking at. And as I said, there are tens of thousands of people already getting engaged. I think we don't see it as much in the U.S. or as visibly, say, as in Europe. On the other hand, there were this day of action you mentioned. There were 65 actions across the U.S. And there are hundreds of groups across the country focusing right now on Fast Track, which is very much about this issue of secrecy.
We've been speaking with Karen Hansen-Kuhn. She's Director of International Strategies at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. You can find them online at iatp.org.
And you have been listening to Counterspin. It's 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The next KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Nappy Farms, specializing in sustainable U-Pick blueberry practices. Nappy Farms U-Pick Blueberries is located at 10280 Southeast Orient Drive in Boring, Oregon. For more information, the number is 503-663-0885 or online at nappyfarms.com. That's NAPPEfarms.com. KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Yay! This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. Please, no home recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 13th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, a three-day, all-ages music festival, Friday, July 22nd through Sunday, July 24th at Audio Cinema in Portland. 43 artists will be performing over the 3 days, including special high school band sets curated by Friends of Noise. The festival also features a record fair, street fair, food carts, and more. Again, that's the 13th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, a three-day, all-ages music festival, Friday, July 22nd through Sunday, July 24th at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tonight, Bread and Roses is taking a break. We're listening to Rising Up with Sonali, produced by Sonali Kolkatkar. We'll hear extended versions of two in-depth interviews, Corey Saylor, National Legislative Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, will discuss a new executive report on Islamophobia in the United States and the well-funded right-wing network that perpetuates it. And award-winning journalist Allison Stewart will share stories from her new book, Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff. Here's Sonali Kolhatkar, Rising Up with Sonali. From Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On today's show, we'll hear extended versions of two in-depth interviews. Corey Saylor, the National Legislative Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, will discuss an extensive report on Islamophobia in the U.S. and the well-funded right-wing network that perpetuates it. Plus, award-winning journalist Allison Stewart will share stories from her book, Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff. That's coming up after the break. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The FBI, after being pressured by the public, released a more complete transcript of the calls made by the Orlando shooter Omar Mateen to police on the night of the massacre at Pulse, a gay bar. Earlier, the FBI had tried to redact the name of the Islamic State and other groups. Mateen seemed to have tried to hit all of the expectations of a so-called homegrown radical Islamic terrorist by citing perhaps every foreign terrorist organization he could think of to pledge allegiance to. Republicans and Democrats ran with the narrative that this was an act of terror right from the beginning, which is no surprise given the anti-Islamic rhetoric that has permeated American culture for many years now. A new report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations, together with the Center for Race and Gender at the University of Berkeley, details the industry of Islamophobia that has been built up in the U.S., how well-funded that industry is, and how far up the government it reaches. Joining me to discuss it is Corey Saylor. He is the National Legislative Director of CARE. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, I want to talk about how things have changed in the U.S. I mean, it's certainly we've had sort of an atmosphere of Islamophobia for many, many years after 9/11 that ramped up. And then in the last few years, it's ramped up again. And I noticed that in your report, you found you've sort of identified a network of groups. And those numbers have changed over the past few years. An inner core group of organizations that kind of are part of this industry, and then an outer supporting core group. Tell us a little bit more about this network.
Sure. So what we did is we looked at a number of different organizations that we've seen using Islamophobic sentiment. And when you review the websites, press releases, activities of some of these groups, you can break them into the two groups, as you said. The inner core, These are 33 groups that we've seen who pretty much their reason for existence is to make people afraid of or hate Muslims. So these would be groups like Pamela Geller's American Freedom Defense Initiative, Jihad Watch run by Robert Spencer. The other group, which is made up of 41 different organizations, we call the Outer Core. So these are organizations who you see using Islamophobic rhetoric, but it's not their sole reason for existence. And the most obvious one there is Fox News. They give a platform to a number of anti-Muslim bigots, but that's not all that they do in their work.
And the money that this industry, this network of organizations have at their disposal is staggering. Can you throw out some dollar amounts?
So the 33 inner core groups that we were talking about, many of them are nonprofit organizations, which means they have to file their tax returns publicly. So when you review those tax returns, and we went through more than 500 of them for the report, between 2008 and 2013, those 33 groups had available to them at least $205 million in total revenue. Which means that, you know, their smear campaign, their campaign to make people hate Muslims, had a significant amount of finances behind it. And we talk about the impact in the report, you know, of that financing.
I mean, $205 million. I can't even picture, you know, organizations like yours, media outlets like mine, having access to even a fraction of that funding. And just to compare, I mean, CARE's annual operating expenses are just something like a few million a year, right?
4 to 5 million a year. Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about what they do with this money. $205 million. Where are they getting it from? There are some large foundations, family foundations that are pouring money into this industry, this network of Islamophobic groups.
So unfortunately, there are some foundations, and some of them with names that I found a little surprising. Let's talk about Donald Rumsfeld's foundation. Not a significant amount of money, but that a foundation associated with Donald Rumsfeld would be giving money to anti-Muslim bigots is a bit troubling, given that he used to be the Secretary of Defense. There's lesser known names, for instance, the Abstraction Fund. It's a foundation that's owned by someone who inherited some of the Sears and Roebuck family money. 82%, when we looked at the numbers, of the money from that foundation goes to some of these inner core groups. And then there's well-known institutions, for instance, like Donors Capital Fund, which is a fund where wealthy donors who want to remain anonymous can give money to the fund, say where they want that money to go, and then the fund itself gives the donation. To give you a sense, one of the largest ever individual contributions that anyone's been able to identify was in 2008. A businessman named Bar Sayed gave $18 million to a group called the Clarion Project to enable that group to distribute an anti-Muslim video to battleground states during the election cycle that year.
Now, the man you just mentioned sounds like he has a Muslim name.
I don't actually know what his background is. He's not a Muslim. We know that for sure.
So let's talk about what they do with this money. In many ways, this isn't just about promoting certain kinds of rhetoric. It's about actually changing policies. Let's first focus on the legislation that we have seen in many states and even local parts of the country that are attempting to undermine just the, you would imagine, the sort of religious freedoms of Muslims. What sort of legislation, I mean, how can you, first of all, legislate a religion, right?
So first and foremost, I think you made a very important point there. And that is that people, this is not just people saying mean things. This is people actually attempting to undermine constitutional protections of free religious exercise. And how it sort of evolved is to me quite fascinating as well. What they do is they sidestep the Constitution by introducing bills that say they're going to ban foreign law. The template bill that they use is called American Laws for American Courts. It was written by a gentleman named David Yerushalmi. American Laws for American Courts says we're going to ban foreign law. it gets introduced into state legislature. But when you look at the conversations that legislators have around it, it's very clear that the foreign law idea is a dog whistle, because they always talk about Sharia and the threat of Islam to this country. And so far, that American Laws for American Courts, written by one man, David Yerushalmi, has been passed in 8 states, and then other variations of anti-Islam legislation have been passed in 2 states, for a grand total of 10 states. 1/5 of the country has enacted legislation that's intended to vilify Muslims.
And give us some examples of what those pieces of legislation are. I mean, if they want to try to undermine or say, you know, Sharia law is illegal here, how does that even work, given that Sharia law is not really a legal thing to begin with? It's part of a religious framework, right?
And it's also a false flag. So Muslims, like many other religious communities, Catholics, people of the Jewish faith, we sometimes will, when we have a dispute or have a contract to write, go to religious representatives so that it can be done within our understanding of our faith. And as long as those contracts that are signed are legal under the U.S. code, such things should be enforceable in courts. But what the actual impact of these laws, because they use foreign law, and the language that's in American Laws for American Courts specifically says, you know, is essentially that if anything that happens violates the Constitution, then that's illegal, is redundant, because that's what the Constitution says.
So then essentially, are these pieces of legislation and these efforts at passing legislation a purely symbolic exercise?
To date, absolutely. We haven't seen any of these laws used in court at this point in time. So if you're looking for a vehicle to smear a religion and have leaders in a state say horrible things about a faith, this is a perfect vehicle for it, which is why we see it so often. When a legislature has used actually the term Sharia or the term Islam in one of these bills, it gets dealt with fairly quickly. Oklahoma is the key example, because that's where it actually went to court. They passed a law in Oklahoma that said that judges in that state would not be able to consider Sharia or foreign law. We sued them, the organization I work for, CARE, 2 days after it was introduced. 3 years later, that law was deemed unconstitutional by an appeals court. And think about the Oklahoma area. This is not a liberal area, right? So that these were not liberal judges. So far, fortunately, we have seen the judiciary, at least, remembering what the Bill of Rights is about and making sure that Muslims, at least in that venue, get equal protections under the law.
And of course, it's a tremendous amount of expense at taxpayers, from taxpayers' wallets, if you will, to even have all of these moving through the courts, especially when the other side is so well-funded. Okay, so aside from legislation, what are the other ways in which the money is spent? In the outer group of the sort of supporting network of Islam, of the Islamophobic industry, are many media outlets. You mentioned Fox News. In there is, you know, someone who's sometimes considered a liberal, like Bill Maher, Real Time with Bill Maher, but also people like the Rush Limbaugh show, etc. Does the money that you cite also fund these media outlets, or do they sort of bring their own money to the table?
Well, most of the media outlets we place in the outer core, and we don't try to quantify the funding there, because it's simply impossible. Right. You can't really figure out how much it is. And the numbers become astronomical in that case. So really what you're looking at is anti-Muslim propaganda that's coming out through these venues. I'll go back to Fox News. Public Religion Research Institute in 2012 did a study of conservatives. And what they found is that conservatives who trust Fox News over other news outlets, that correlated with not liking Muslims. So something about watching Fox News tends to have a negative impact on people's opinions of Muslims. I would argue with you, and this is the case on why many of these different media outlets were included, because they give a platform to anti-Muslim actors like Daniel Pipes, Robert Spencer, Pamela Geller. And in our minds, that's the equivalent of giving a representative of an anti-Semitic organization or a white supremacist organization a legitimizing platform. And we think just as society rejects white supremacist rhetoric, rejects anti-Semitic rhetoric, it should also be rejecting this anti-Muslim rhetoric.
And so just to kind of step back, then you have a lot of these organizations like Pamela Geller's group, et cetera, with a lot of money they get from different sources, including family foundations. They spend it on helping to pass these symbolic legislation, piece of legislation intended to demonize Islam. They get on these networks and express themselves and reach members of the public, who then in turn become influenced and sometimes show up on the streets in front of mosques or protesting mosques, maybe pushing vandalism and possibly committing hate crimes and discrimination. Is that an important way for us to sort of look at how this works, this kind of world of the Islamophobic network works?
Well, I think an important thing to understand, and in your introduction, you talked about this a little bit, you know, what's the change been over many years? And we say that Islamophobic activity tends to go in cycles. So the last really bad cycle was in 2010. If you remember the whole debate over Park 51, what was called the Ground Zero Mosque, we saw a spike in episodes where people tried to push back against the construction or expansion of mosques. And we tracked about 50-something anti-mosque incidents that year. Normally, we will track about 20 anti-mosque incidents per year. Last year, we tracked 78 anti-mosque incidents, with the majority of them having to do with damage, destruction, vandalism, or intimidation. So the tone has really changed. It's gone from just trying to push back in city council hearings over mosques to people going out and trying to do actual damage to religious facilities. So these are things like a mosque in California that was firebombed, a mosque in Connecticut that someone shot bullets into it. So people are not just sitting passively taking in this anti-Muslim propaganda. Some people decide to take the law in their own hands and go out and make people they perceive as being Muslim pay.
You also identify in your report a number of individual figures, and we've thrown out some names already, such as Pamela Geller. And I want to get to some people who actually occupy office, elected office in this country. But there are figures like Ayaan Hirsi Ali. There's people like I mentioned Bill Maher and some other folks who you point out in your report. Who are the sort of stars of Islamophobia, if you will, who it's worth identifying for some of the hateful rhetoric that they seem to be spreading?
So there's actually one group that I will really point you to at this point, because their impact on this election cycle has been troubling to say the least. And that group is Frank Gaffney's Center for Security Policy, which, if you remember, I mentioned the name David Yerushalmi, who wrote the American Laws for American Courts bill. David Yerushalmi works there. The reason I've become so troubled by Center for Security Policy lately is, if you remember Donald Trump's call for Muslims to be banned from this country, in the text of Trump's press release, they cite a very flawed poll conducted by the Center for Security Policy. And then Ted Cruz, when he announced his National Security Advisory Group, three staff members from the Center for Security Policy were on that group. So this is a group that, this is America, you have the right to say what you want to say, even if it's false. That is protected, and I stand for that. But I believe that such groups like Center for Security Policy should be at the fringe of any conversation. But what we've seen is they've been able to assert themselves right into the center of the nation's political discourse during this presidential election cycle.
So let's talk about the other aspect of this report, which I think is really important. You don't just identify the Islamophobia and the ways in which it manifests, but you also talk about how to tackle it. And actually, to pause that for a minute, I also want to bring up how schools are part of the equation. How has the hateful rhetoric against Islam impacted schools and children?
So to me, this is one of the most troubling parts of the report on a couple of different fronts. First of all, we found that two states, Tennessee and Florida, have changed the way they review textbooks for use in classrooms based on anti-Islam campaigns. So there's nothing specific in the bill that talks about Islam. But in each case, you could see anti-Muslim activity and then the legislation getting introduced. What is being asserted here in many cases is simply teaching people, kids, the very basic fundamental facts about Islam is converted in anti-Muslim bigots' minds to indoctrinating children to become Muslims. So the five pillars of Islam, the sort of key beliefs, the first one is there is no God but God. Muhammad is the prophet of God. Simply having a teacher tell that to a student gets converted in the minds of some of these Islamophobes to indoctrination. And they then go out and challenge this. And that's the first point that really troubles me about this, that now what you're doing is you're trying to make sure that kids do not learn basic facts about the world around them, about a billion people. And that puts America at a significant disadvantage if our students are coming out of school without basic facts about what the world looks like. The second part that really troubles me, and this we included this in our study, but it wasn't something that we did. In California, the Council on American Islamic Relations chapters out there interviewed students, and they found that about 54% of the kids reported that they had experienced some form of religion-based bullying. So that's the second part to this. What is happening on TV with the election cycle does not just stay among the adults.
Right.
Kids are taking it to school, and they're picking on other kids, which is really, to me, one of the most repulsive parts of what we saw in this report.
Right. And in fact, there have been specific reports focusing on the bullying that Muslim kids are facing increasingly in schools, a terrible development. I'm speaking with Corey Saylor. He is the National Legislative Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. And we're talking about a new report on Islamophobia that CARE put together along with the Center for Race and Gender at UC Berkeley. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're going to keep Corey on for an extended conversation about the report, which you can watch in our premium content section of our website. Corey, let's talk about how the information in the report can be marshaled to actually combating Islamophobia. This isn't just an informative report. This is a report that lays out a map or, you know, a pathway to digging the U.S. out of this atmosphere that we find ourselves in right now. How do you explain, now knowing the information that you know through this report, how we could combat this industry of Islamophobia?
Well, and thank you for pointing that out. CARE is an advocacy organization, not academics. So when we put out work, we always like to attach to it some kind of action that people can take. We don't want to just give you news that leaves you feeling troubled. We want to give you some way to deal with it. And what we had done, we published a report in 2013 called Legislating Fear, in which we first identified a number of these anti-Muslim groups. And we really focused on delegitimizing their work. And we feel like we've gotten pretty good at it. But to us, it just didn't reach the level of change in society that we were looking for. So let's call that a counter-opposition strategy, what we were doing in the past. What we're proposing in this new report is something we would call a counter-environment strategy. So you change the acceptability of anti-Muslim sentiment in society, and it's based on what we saw happen to the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan. Back in the 1920s, popular group, being associated with them was considered something to, you know, in some circles, something, you know, desirable. And today, still legal, but at the very much at the fringe of society. And what they have to say, nobody listens to. So that's what we're looking at in our report, changing the environment so that when these anti-Muslim groups get up and speak, nobody's paying any attention to them because they're not considered legitimate. And I'll quickly outline the four key points of that strategy. The first is we believe that the Sharia, the Islamic religious principles, the two goals that are laid out in Sharia historically are be a benefit to humanity, avert harm from humanity. And I always like to point out, that's not be a benefit to Muslims, avert harm from Muslims, that's humanity. And I would argue to you that because the Muslim community has been in survival mode since 9/11, we sometimes forget those principles. So it's time for us to really start stepping up our alliances with other social justice movements, because that's what our faith tells us to do. So we're encouraging Muslims to get out there and be a more visible part of immigration reform, Black Lives Matter, humanitarian causes. If you saw the news coming out of Flint, Michigan, when they needed more water there, there were many Muslims on the front lines of making sure that happened. So that's one point. Second point is we want to train more diverse spokespeople to represent the Muslim community. This is not a monolithic community by any stretch of the imagination. You have very liberal people, you have very conservative people. They should all be part of the national dialogue. So we're going to be making sure that people get a better understanding of how to project their voice into the public discussion.
Right. Even racially, the Muslim community is extremely diverse. In fact, I understand the largest racial group within Muslims is actually African Americans.
It breaks down to about thirds. African Americans make up about a third of the community. Southeast Asians about a third, and Arabs about a third. Mm. So, and you know, also we have Muslims from every nation on the planet in this country. So the diversity is amazing. And I think that gives us an opportunity to have some really interesting conversations within our community. And hopefully that allows us to project some really interesting ideas to the rest of society on solving some of the nation's problems. So the last two key points to our strategy, first of all, we want to also, and you've already heard me saying this, we want society to look at Islamophobia the same way it looks at anti-Semitism, the same way it looks at white supremacism, an ideology that's disgusting, that should be legally protected. People should be free to say what they want to say, but should never be part of a mainstream conversation. So people have the right to say what they want to say in dingy hotel rooms that they've rented. It should not be part of the dialogue on the floor of a state legislature, right? It just makes sense to us. And then the last point, we want Muslims to become more involved in the public sector in the United States. You've heard people talking about that for many years, but I just don't think we've seen the gains that are possible of Muslims getting, you know, working on Capitol Hill, we're getting into the administration, being involved in effective political campaigning. So, you know,
or even running for office, right? I mean, we have like what, one Muslim congressman in the country, or maybe more?
Two. One from Indiana, one from Minnesota. And there truly need to be more, and not just in the U.S. Congress. Most things, you know, all politics is local. So city council, school boards, that's, we need to have a presence. And, you know, based on that first point that I was talking about, be a benefit to humanity, I think that people that come from the Islamic faith have ideas that we should be presenting to benefit the communities that we live in. And you see that to a degree, but I'd really like to ramp it up.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Corey, for joining us today. Give out a website where people can find out both more about CARE as well as the report that we've been discussing.
So the report can be downloaded from Islamophobia.org. And that will also lead you on to CARE's main website. But I really do invite people to go take a look at Islamophobia.org. We'll be putting the text of the entire report up there over the next few days. And, you know, let us make our case to you. See if you find our ideas appealing. And if you do, get involved with the movement. I believe it's very important that if you want to uphold the Constitution in the United States, we have to make sure that things that are going on, like attempts to take away the religious rights of minority groups through things like American laws for American courts, that's where the struggle has to be. I say Muslims are on the front line of defending the Constitution today. I'd like people to come and see my argument for that. And as I said, if they buy into it, join up and let's all work together.
The website again is Islamophobia.org. CARE's own website is CARE.com, CAIR.com. And the name of the report is Confronting Fear. Corey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Corey Saylor is the National Legislative Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Here are some shocking statistics about how Americans live. According to the Los Angeles Times, the average American home has 300,000 items. The average size of homes in the U.S. has nearly tripled over the past half century. And still, 10% of all Americans rent space outside their homes to store the stuff that doesn't fit. In fact, storage rental is apparently the fastest growing part of the real estate industry. Well, exploring our propensity to collect and store stuff is my guest, Allison Stewart. In her new book, Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff, she met all sorts of Americans, hoarders, trash removal experts, and artists who use found objects. Allison Stewart is an award-winning journalist whose 20-year career includes anchoring and reporting for NBC News, ABC News, and CBS News. She got her start covering politics for MTV News. She's the author of First Class, The Legacy of Dunbar, America's First Black Public High School. And she's currently a contributing correspondent for PBS and the host of Follow Your Past on the Travel Channel. She now joins me to discuss her new book, Junk. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I confess when I was reading your book, it made me think about myself, and I wondered constantly if I was a sort of mild hoarder, you know? I mean, it feels like each one of us has our thing. Like, I can't bring myself to throw away glass jars. I don't know why, but that's just the way it is. So tell us about what got you started on this journey to explore why Americans just can't bring themselves to throw stuff away. Also, why they just buy so much stuff. How did it all start?
It all started because my folks passed away fairly close to each other, and they were Depression era. They were born in 1929, both of them. And, you know, after sort of the mourning and the grief of losing your parents, you have to get down to the business of, oh, gosh, what do we do with the family home? And I think we all always knew the basement was going to be an issue. My parents were, like, were educated, sophisticated people with a beautiful home, but they had this basement full of stuff. And I have to fully admit that a lot of that stuff was my own stuff, stuff that I decided, you know, I really will need a copy of The Odyssey when I'm 35 years old from high school, you know. And as my sister lived out of state, and I was in between professional gigs, and I thought, well, let me just tackle this job of cleaning out the basement. And I went down there, and it was terrifying in some ways, because there just was so much stuff. It wasn't a hoarding situation. It was a junk situation. And I became very overwhelmed by it, and I realized I needed professional help, and I called in a junk removal team. And as I talked to the guy, the lead guy, he came back four different times. He would tell me interesting stories about people's homes he went to. And then when I would go to my son's basketball games and tell people what I was doing, that everybody had a story. Everybody about themselves, about their parent, about their sister, who seemed to have just a lot of stuff. And my reporter radar went up, and I thought, there's something going on here in America. Americans have some sort of secret. They're having some sort of relationship with all this stuff in their lives. And sort of the funny part about the title of the book is, like, some love affairs are great and some are not. Some are toxic. So I realized there was something going on, and I really wanted to investigate it because it had such a tremendous impact on me personally, and I knew I just couldn't be alone in this.
So what is the difference between someone who hoards and someone mm-hmm. who just kind of collects junk and doesn't want to throw it away, and they say they store it somewhere?
Yeah.
I mean, they sound like the same thing to me, but...
Really, you know what? You start to peel back the layers, you realize they're not. You know, and I talk about that a little bit in the book, the difference between collectors and the difference between hoarders, the difference between people who have some sort of disorganized, they're challenged with their disorganization. And as one psychologist put it to me, if you're somebody who's just sort of overwhelmed by your stuff, whether it's because you have too much, your living space is too small, you're cognitively vulnerable because you have ADD or ADHD, he said, if elves showed up in the middle of the night and cleaned your house and got rid of everything, you would be so psyched and thrilled. If elves showed up in the middle of the night at a hoarder's house, they would be horrified. They would be distressed, distraught, and that house would be filled up again in 2 weeks.
I see.
So kind of an interesting way to think about it. Hmm.
So a hoarder is somebody who seems to have this sort of psychological need to be surrounded by stuff, where someone who just can't throw stuff away and is just living in clutter just can't bring themselves to clean but would love to.
They would love to. They would love the help. Yeah. In fact, hoarding, it was always confused with OCD, was often confused with OCD, I should say. And in 2013, it was given its own designation, the DSM, because people came to realize and psychologists came to realize this is actually, hoarding is actually a mental disorder. And there are some amazing studies and work being done about hoarding. My book is not so much about hoarding, it's kind of about the rest of us. Although I do touch on hoarding, because this was one of the things I discovered in my research, is there's a community of people who are adult children of hoarders. And the people who are my age, in their 40s and their 50s, who before the television show Hoarders never realized there were people out there like them. Hmm. And many of them really like the television show Hoarders, which people sometimes think might be a little bit prurient, a little bit voyeuristic. But some of those folks say, you know what, that was the end of my isolation. This is when I found out there were people like me. So I talk about the children of hoarders and their support group a little bit in the book. But really, I try to delve into all the different people and all the different systems and the economies that have bubbled up because we have so much stuff.
Right. And so let's talk about that, because the fact is we live in a consumer culture. Our economy for a long time has depended upon Americans earning money and spending as much of that money as possible on buying stuff, which in turn keeps corporations in business. Now, of course, the majority of our stuff comes from China, where labor is extremely cheap. Mm-hmm. It's also underpaid and it's also abusive, but that's another conversation. And so you can go out and you can spend $100 on your child's Christmas present and buy them like 20 things because stuff is just so cheap. So how is our propensity to buy, our sort of need to, and the fact that we end up consuming so much related to our economy?
You're so right. You've hit the nail on the head. It was something that I sort of suspected, and as I was doing more digging, it's really interesting that all these junk adjacent economies started to bubble up in the 80s, almost all of them. And it was after our relations with China changed. And once upon a time, to get a lot of junk, you had to have money. You had to have a lot of money to do it. Now you don't. You hit the nail right on the head. You can come home with a bag full of toys made somewhere, and each one is 99 cents, and you're stuck with them. You know, I have a little kid. I don't know if you have a kid or not.
I do, too. And
birthday party gift
oh,
bags.
Oh, yeah. Yes, goodie bags. Oh, God.
So it's interesting. It also became, in the late 70s and 80s, it was actually the wiser economic choice was to buy new than to fix. Because by the time you got someone out to your house to fix the thing that was broken and order the part, you might as well order a new one. That was another issue that came about. Planned obsolescence also plays into this.
Right, appliances that essentially are designed to have a shorter lifespan so that you go out and buy a new one or buy the latest model, which is supposed to be better, but of course design tend to not last very long.
And I think what we're seeing right about now is that all those chickens are coming home to roost. I thought it was very interesting, just recently, Apple has finally got into a reuse program for its electronics. You know, for a while, you could find four generations of iPads under one roof, and people didn't know what to do with these. And now there's become an economy in refurbishing them, and Apple has finally gotten in on this. And now you can actually, this was announced, I think, on the March 21st, 2016, their big announcement. This was part of their big announcements that we'll take back old products now. I think people have started to realize we've hit sort of a saturation point with the amount of things we have. And the way we keep filling our homes and the way we keep expanding our lives to accommodate this, whether it be storage units or bigger houses or going to the container store to find something pretty to put it all in. It was part of what I wanted to do with this book. When I wondered if it was regional. I wondered if it was just particular to the United States. So I went across the country and I worked with five independent junk removal companies in five different cities and did ride-alongs with them for about three to four days each.
So there's this whole like industry that's built up around helping people get rid of their stuff.
Yes. There's several of them. There's the professional organizers. There's an organization called NAPO, National Association of Professional Organizers. There are about 4,000 of them in the United States. They're sort of like superheroes. They're people who help you get organized and set up systems so that you can contain or at least keep track of what's going on in your house. But these junk removal companies are really fascinating. There's a couple of national chains. I think we all know who they are. I wanted to find out, go along with small independent people who had started their own companies to find out what kind of junk was in each kind of town, how they came to the business, why the business is so profitable. You know, there are some people who don't really understand, like, what do you mean? I'm gonna pay you to take my stuff? A lot of people don't understand that, but I have to tell you, when these junk removal people come up to people's homes, they are so grateful for the help, the homeowners quite often. They just need the relief. And in fact, one of the large companies, when you call up and you make an appointment, the first thing they say to you on the phone is, how can we help you have a stress-free day? Which I think is very telling.
Right.
That you have all this stuff really is causing stress and distress in a lot of people's lives.
Right. And, you know, we spend our money on cheap stuff because it's tempting. You know, it's cheap. You should buy it. And then we also have trouble throwing stuff away because, I mean, for example, I have trouble throwing away something that might be reusable simply because when I look at the item, I think, you know, I could either throw this away or somewhere down the line I might have to buy a new one, and that's not being very eco-friendly, right? And so our desire for environmentalism has also resulted in many of us hanging on to stuff. How does that play into the story?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So much of, not so much, let me just roll that back. For many people, there is a sort of virtuous aspect of this. Depression era people, that's a perfectly good thing. How can you throw that away? That's wasteful.
Right, there's a generational divide on this that you point out in your book.
Right? So that's a big issue, but it's also virtue in it. And the virtue in, I am not adding this to a landfill. I'm going to keep this in my home and I'm going to use it again. But I guess the question you have to ask for yourself, and this is something I kind of come to at the end of the book, is this, if it is causing you stress, if something is, I'm not anti-junk by any means, I'm not anti-possession. I do want to make that clear. The last chapter in the book is about someone who loves junk and lives with it and thrives with it. But the question is, what purpose is it serving for you right now? What is this object, this item doing for you right now? If it is making you feel good because you're saving the environment, you think you might need it, you know you might need it, it's useful to you at this moment, great, keep it. I'm not saying people need to throw their things away. I think we just need to be incredibly mindful about what we bring into our homes and what we keep in our homes.
Right.
Kind of like junk food, right? You can get five hamburgers for a dollar, but should you?
Should you, right. Good question. Now, going back to what you were saying about planned obsolescence and our manufacturing these days, tell us about the repair cafe that you visited in the journey that you took to write your book, because there are these cafes, if you will, all over the world now where environmental organizations come together and organize a time and day when you can bring your broken appliances or torn clothes and get them fixed by experts, which is a great way to not have to throw stuff out and buy new stuff.
Isn't it so simple? It's really a terrific idea. That was something in the last sort of portion of the book I wanted to offers people and explore people who had solutions to the problem, because sometimes you can feel really overwhelmed by this subject. And so the repair cafes were started by a woman in Europe who was a journalist who was dealing with environmental issues. She just thought there's got to be a better way to deal with our things that are broken or slightly broken. And it started very organically. If somebody got a room, they put out a call for volunteer tinkerers, come down at this time, and told people, you know, you can come in and just have something fixed for free. And it just made so much sense. So she exported the idea, started a nonprofit, and there's sort of a basic kit you can get if you decide to do this in your community. The community I followed was upstate New York, the Hudson Valley, Catskill area. A former television producer who had moved into the area, who's a tinkerer himself, organized it. He went to see some retired men. They had a club called the Retired Men of New Paltz. He said, hey, I know you guys all know how to fix toasters and broken chair legs. And they meet once a month in a community space, and anybody can show up and bring something to be fixed. And these are all over the country, in the West Coast, in the Palo Alto area, Silicon Valley area. It's very heavily electronics and you know, really highly trained engineers doing it. Up in the Hudson Valley, it was a lot of folks who had simple things like a light, a lamp they loved that if they took it to try to be fixed in a store would cost $50, when all it needed is a switch and someone who knew how to fix the switch. So it's a really lovely idea, and people are so grateful that there are people who volunteer their time to fix things. And everybody there has a sort of an environmental bent for sure, but it's also a real nice community thing.
Now, I mean, the repair cafes, aren't they filling the void that appliance repair shops used to have in the country? I used to be able to take my sewing machine to a shop down the street and get it tuned up and repaired, and that shop closed down. Like, so many appliance repair shops have closed down. I don't know if it's a cost of labor, etc., but there was a time in the United States when the bones of your appliance were strong, and so if one little thing fell apart, you could take it to the shop down the street. You didn't have to be under warranty. You would pay a little money, but it was usually not much, and you could get it fixed. You could get your shoes fixed. You could get your shoes resold. If your handbag broke its strap, you could go to the same place you get your shoes resold might fix your strap for you. And that's becoming rare, isn't it?
It is. And you know, there's a couple of reasons for that, that the folks at the repair cafe, they all told me, and this is anecdotal, but I think we all know it's the case. A lot of them will say things are made so poorly and cheaply now, they almost can't be repaired. This one seamstress said, you know, people will bring something in that they love that they bought, and they'll just explain, like, this is poor quality. It's not made with the same kind of quality. All the furniture guys will tell you this. The junk removal guys will tell you this too. Old furniture is extremely heavy because it's so well made. Now, if you bring in something that you bought in a big box store to be fixed, you know it's going to break again in a week. So that's, again, back to the planned obsolescence of it all. So I think there's a lack of quality materials, although you're seeing that change, I think, with some, you know, startups and Kickstarter campaigns of people who want to sell things at an ethical cost with good quality merchandise, but it's going to cost you more money.
Yeah, and this again goes back to our consumer culture, our consumer economy, and the corporate profit model. Now, one of the things that you explore in your book, which I thought was really interesting, is how artists are repurposing junk to use in their art. Tell us about Vince Henneman, an artist in Austin, whom you spoke with for your book.
Yeah, it was actually kind of hard. There were so many different interesting artists using junk. But I found Vince Hanneman's case to be quite fascinating. He is an artist in Austin, Texas. And in his backyard is something that is called the Cathedral of Junk. It's about three stories high. It's a piece of artwork he's been working on for two decades. It is extraordinary. It almost defies description.
For our TV audience, we have some photographs we're showing of the Cathedral of Junk.
Go home and Google it. And you can spend hours with pictures, seeing pictures of the Cathedral of Junk. And it's sort of interesting. People really have a sense of peace. They're reverential when they go in it. And Hanneman's kind of an irascible character. Depends on the day you find him. which Vince Hanneman you're going to get, the lovely artist or the guy who is going to throw you out, which he practically did by the time we finished our conversation. Which is why I literally transcribed his interview word for word, because he often says he's misquoted in the press. It's an expression of what's going on in his head, which is chaotic and gorgeous and overwhelming and funny, but also terrifying at the same time. And it has become a real landmark in Austin for people who are sort of more traveler than tourist. It was really extraordinary, and to watch people's reactions to it, because it makes no sense and complete sense at the same time as you're walking through it.
My guest is Alison Stewart, and we're talking about her book, Junk, Digging Through America's Love Affair with Stuff. And we're going to continue our conversation with her now for an extended interview that you can find on our website at risingupwithsonali.com. Alison, one of the other interesting things in your book was this issue of how our junk has literally left the planet and is orbiting us. Space junk. This is a bizarre part of the story. How did you end up exploring the junk that's literally orbiting us?
I started thinking about our attitude about junk. That was sort of an underlying theme in the book. Like, what are our attitudes? Like, does it apply just to the stuff in our house? Well, no, it applies to other things like our science and our food and our investments, junk bonds. And I thought about space junk. I'd seen the movie Gravity like everyone else. And I thought, could that really happen? And I started researching it. And I thought, oh my gosh, this could actually really happen. And I started researching. I said, are we just leaving stuff up there? And the idea is that we, the collective people in the United States and in China and Russia, just think space is full of space, not really realizing that when all of these different space missions happen and things get left behind, we're littering the lower Earth orbit, which sounds okay. So there's stuff whizzing around in space. Well, there's also satellites and things that control GPS and anything that you ever download in this conversation we're having right now. Everything in the lower Earth orbit, and that's the area that we would use for space exploration and towards moving toward the future, is starting to become uninhabitable because there's so much space junk that's been left around. And there were a couple of scientists who were prescient about this, who realized it was going to happen. And one of them is a gentleman named Don Kessler, and he lives in Asheville, North Carolina. He's a retired scientist. And in 1978, they called it the Kessler syndrome because he raised the red flag saying, hey, we have to stop doing this. We have to stop just leaving stuff. It's like if you just started leaving stuff in your front yard and never just kept putting old refrigerators out there, largely because of the way that the velocity with which the pieces of junk move. The big junk is tracked by government agencies, but it's the little stuff going around at amazing speeds that could ding a satellite, that could ding the International Space Station. The astronauts.
How does the junk get there, by the way?
Well, they leave boosters. Huh. Pieces of metal come off of shuttles. They come off of space stations. Paint chips are a big issue, apparently. People if they lose a glove, if they lose, some of it is left over from the actual mission that they're just leaving it out there. They're just assuming that it's not going to be an issue. And the big pieces aren't an issue. Sometimes, if two pieces of big space junk collide, they'll create more, which is really a huge issue. One country blew up one of its own satellites to see if it could, and that created a huge amount of space junk. That's considered one of the biggest accidents, quote-unquote accidents. Right now, the race is on, and people are acting in a cooperative manner. Countries are acting in a cooperative manner about how do we stop it. We're at this point where it's really dangerous. I do Google alerts for all the subjects in my book, and every day I get a Google alert about some company or some collaboration of scientists trying to figure out what to do about space junk, whether to make a net, whether to bring it down into so it burns up in orbit, lower Earth orbit. We're being quite collaborative. Europe, the United States, China are being quite collaborative about it. Although everybody's a little bit nervous about their intellectual property. about who can pick off my space junk is what you'll find out about our space program, or if you do. But it's something that is fairly serious.
So let's turn back to the junk that we find on Earth. Finally, let's talk about the ways in which there are movements toward, like the Repair Cafe, movements towards living simpler, less cluttered lives. Trend to have tiny homes is a really big one. At least the fascination with it is big. I'm not sure how many people are actually moving out of their 2,500 square foot homes into, you know, 300 square foot spaces. But it's a fascination that we have. There's, you know, always these like images on social media feeds. Look at you can't believe the incredible inside of this tiny home. It's so spacious. Tell us about the tiny home movement.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with you that I think that there is, I'm not sure you've got a whole bunch of people downsizing to this movement, but I believe, because of the demographics, you have some people who are going to be native to it, millennials especially. I went to a tiny house meetup of people who were thinking about it, and they were mostly young, mostly millennials. And I started
asking people can't afford to buy regular homes, right, because of the economy today and the job situation and college debt.
Can't afford to, are used to a shared economy. Mm-hmm. A lot of times these tiny homes are part of larger communities where there's a shared communal space, or they're moving into micro apartments. So they share cars, they share workspaces. Sharing a home space is not that strange. And I started to ask this young woman, I said, well, what about your books and things like that? And she picked up her phone, her smartphone, looked at me, and she said, all my pictures are on here, all my music's on here, all my books are on here, all my contacts are on here, all of my files from my work is on here. And I can realize she really has, there's a whole swath of population that just has a lot less of that kind of stuff. So they don't actually need the space in the way that their parents might. And you know what, I think a lot of us are dealing with parents who are aging, or we're starting to see ourselves in this situation and saying, wait a minute, something needs to change. So I think the tiny house, and one of the people who is really sort of at the forefront of this said, you know, these microscopic ones that are 100 square feet, yes, that's not realistic, but 300 square feet a person, that's realistic. That's kind of where we were once upon a time.
Hey, and that has been Rising Up with Sonali, produced by Sonali Kulhatkar. It's 7 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio.
Tune into KBOO Monday through Thursday from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. for special live convention coverage produced by the Pacifica News Network. Monday, July 25th, through Thursday, July 28th, hear the coverage from the Democratic Convention from Philadelphia, including exclusive content from KBOO reporter Teresa Mitchell. Again, that's July 25th through